Matthew Masterson has come over from Harvard for the afternoon. I'm not so young. When I was a young student, his experiments were so famous.
Thank you, Alan. So it's, wish I'd had the wit to spend a year or two at the MRC. I have no excuse, from which so much of the fundamental advance in molecular biology came and is still coming. So, but at least here I am to tell you about the much less significant things that happened to me at Caltech and my pal Frank Stahl. So I was Linus Pauling's very last graduate student at Caltech. After me, that was it. So came time to have, it was 1953, to get my thesis problem assigned, and I went up to see Professor Pauling, and he put a rock down on his desk and said, "This is a mineral of the element tellurium. Do you know about tellurium, Matt?" "Yes, Professor Pauling." "Well, have you ever smelled hydrogen sulfide?" "Yes, I was a boy chemist." "But I'll bet you've never smelled hydrogen selenide, have you?" "No, no." "Well, it's much worse." "I see, Professor Pauling. But now, did you know that hydrogen telluride smells as much worse than hydrogen selenide as hydrogen selenide does compared to hydrogen sulfide?" "Oh, no." "Well, now, Matt, this mineral is ore of tellurium, and there's some interesting properties, and we have some compounds of tellurium, and we'd like you to do the crystal structure. And I know you'll be very careful, but I should tell you that some chemists who are not so careful somehow ingested small amounts, very small amounts, and acquired what's known as tellurium halitosis. And it's so bad that it isolates one completely from society. And some people who have contracted it have killed themselves. But I know you'll be very careful." Well, I'd wanted to do X-ray crystallography because I wanted to become a biologist. And there are no carbons and nitrogens. I didn't know about phosphorus yet. But no carbons and nitrogens in the salts of tellurium. So I said, "Couldn't you give me a compound that has carbons and nitrogens because I'm interested in biology?" Now, I don't know if, and maybe Jack does know, if this was just a gag that Linus pulled on every student or whether he really meant it. But anyway, he said, "All right, come back again, we'll talk some more." I did, and he gave me NN prime dimethylmalonimid. Now, why that? Well, it has two peptide groups symmetrically placed about the central carbon. And he, of course, by that time had already staked his life on the planarity of the amid group. But this thing has two amid groups, and I guess he just wanted some more proof that would convince I don't know who, because everyone should have already been convinced that the planar group is indeed planar. And he got to that from his resonance theory, which made him essentially an outlaw in the Soviet Union. It wasn't just Mendel and Morgan who were enemies of Soviet science, but also Linus, even though he was elected, and it comes to be very important for some molecular biology that I'll mention, to the Academia Nauk, the Soviet Academy of Sciences. But before that, the resonance theory for, I don't understand the Marxist theory behind it, but it didn't fit with what I guess Stalin thought was important. So here I am learning X-ray crystallography from Holmes Sturtevant, who Jack will remember. We weren't allowed to drink in the lab. And Holmes Sturtevant would come late at night to check the refrigerators. He was a professor at Caltech, a wonderful man, actually, with an intimidating southern accent. And one time, Linus's graduate students, he called us his boys. There were no girls at Caltech. We were sitting around talking, and Holmes came in, looked in the refrigerator, and saw there were beer cans there, and closed it quietly, said nothing, and then he saw there was a tin can in the refrigerator where we put the 25-cent pieces to pay for the beer. And he said, "Gentlemen, don't you know that it's prohibited at Caltech to put money in refrigerators?" So got the point. But I'm telling you that because there was this dual character to being a graduate student at Caltech. Linus was absolutely available. It took maybe some time before you could get to see him, but once you got in to his office, it was almost painful to get out because he could talk about anything and you could talk about almost nothing. And he kept on talking. So he used to give advice by telling stories, and I'll come to that. Anyway, the next thing for me, being in chemistry, I wasn't in the biology division, but rather in the division of chemistry and chemical engineering, but I wanted to meet Max Delbruck because I wanted to become a biologist, but I was afraid of him because Martin Karpeles, my friend in chemistry, one of Linus's students, had a fierce argument with Max, and Max anyway had a dreadful reputation as, well, I went to see Max. This is already 1954, and I'd never heard of the double helix. He was a year later. And Max's first question was, what do you think about these two papers by Watson and Crick? And I said, I'd never heard of them. And he had a stack of reprints, maybe Jim had sent him, behind his desk on a shelf, and he grabbed them all and he threw them at me, and they fluttered. He never sought power. Max had a very small office. He was actually a very extremely decent man, and said, get out and don't come back till you read them. Well, I heard the words come back. But to go back meant I had to understand X-ray diffraction from helices. And I remember standing upstairs, maybe the third floor in Crellin Lab, which has a stairwell down to the basement, and there was Jack Dunitz and Alex Rich talking about Bessel functions. And I remember straining to hear what... I just don't think I ever really did understand how you get Bessel functions by a Fourier transform from a helix, but I tried. Anyway, at some point, and I don't remember the exact dates, Jacques Monod came back to Caltech. He had been there much earlier, founded the Bach Society of Pasadena. And in his lecture, he referred to the fact that at that time, it was unclear as to whether beta-galactosidase, the activity of which is induced by inducer, I don't know if they had thiogalactoside yet, but certainly by lactose. But the question was, is the enzyme sitting there inside the cell in an inactive form, and the inducer merely tweaks it somehow and makes it active, or is it synthesized de novo? And Monod suggested that one way to answer this question would be to measure the change in osmotic pressure across the bacterial cell membrane, the Donnan effect. And I thought, this is hopeless. We don't know anything about the properties of the bacterial membrane or wall or whatever it is, and there could be holes in it, and there's all kinds of other stuff. And this seemed to me a really awful idea. I had been taking Linus's course on the nature of the chemical bond, and I was overwhelmed with the fact that you could calculate the ratio of the strength of the deuterium bond to the hydrogen bond with a one-line proof based on the quantum mechanical zero-point energy. That just seemed to me just like magic. And so I became very interested, wanting to enter biology, how to do it. Oh, maybe deuterium has the secret of biology somehow. Could you make a mouse out of deuterium instead of hydrogen? And there's a guy who actually tried this at Columbia. The mouse died. It may have been heavy elements. I don't know if it was actually the deuterium, but someone had already grown bacteria in heavy. So I was thinking about that, and hearing Monod's speech made me think, the way to really find out whether the enzyme was already there or not is to grow the bacteria in heavy water and then take them out of the heavy water and induce them in light water and then see if the activity of the enzyme would float or sink in a solution in a centrifuge adjusted to have a density just between what you'd calculate for deuterated beta-galactosidase and for protonated. So I went to Linus and I told him about this and he smiled. And I told Jim about this because Jim was living at the Athenaeum, spending that year at Caltech trying to get RNA structure, and I was living at the Athenaeum. I must admit, Jim, it was very hard for me to understand what you were saying. But I think you said go to Sweden to do it. And why you said go to Sweden, I'm not quite sure. But it involves centrifuges or maybe something else about Caltech. Anyway, I went back to see Max, and now Max was consumed with the problem of getting the two chains apart. And he thought it would be inelegant to try and separate them by any kind of unwinding, and instead thought that maybe you break every eighth bond and rearrange them. Actually, I think Max was closer to the truth than is sometimes realized. He made the rejoining bonds not within the old helix, but between old and new. So this would mean that the daughter molecules would be a mosaic of old and new. Every eight bases you'd have old or new. So this made what was called dispersive replication, not semi-conservative. But if he was right, you do need breaks, but of course we didn't know about topoisomerases then, which do make breaks and make them in the parent helix so that you still conserve the backbone of the parental chains. So in that sense, Max was actually... So there were these three models that were talked about, and then Max wrote a paper about it in the PNAS, and then a longer thing with Gunther Stent in the McCullum-Pratt Symposium book. And there was conservative and semi-conservative and dispersive, and there was another kind that nobody so far has ever mentioned or talked about. You could call it destructive. You use the double helix to stamp out two copies and throw away the double helix. Why not? So the first time I met Francis, Jim asked me if I would come to Woods Hole to do an experiment, but ostensibly as a teaching assistant in the physiology course that Jim and Francis were teaching at Woods Hole at the Marine Biological Lab, the physiology course in 1954. And I remember being impressed that Francis would even take the time to talk to a graduate student. I didn't form a very clear impression of Francis at that point, though. But I do remember that he and Jim and Sidney Brenner was there too. We're talking about the organization of the course. And at some point, Jim went to the window and he pointed outside. This must have been up maybe on the third floor of the library building, and across the street there are some trees and grass. And I think Jim said something like, "You see that fellow down there? He thinks he's pretty smart. Let's give him the whole Hershey-Chase experiment to do in one afternoon, see how good he really is." Well, I felt sorry for this poor fellow. So I went down and introduced myself. That was Frank Stahl. And he was sitting there with a large bucket of ice and gin and tonic water and glasses, and he was selling gins and tonics. Frank was penniless, but somewhat alcoholic at that time. Not at all anymore. He was working out a problem that involved, was called, cross-reactivation, damaged phage DNA with X-rays or P32 disintegration. I won't go into that. But anyway, he was doing some calculations, and what he needed to do was some simple Poisson integrals, and now he knows a lot more math than I do, I think, but I did know how to do that. So I did that for him without understanding the biology, but I could do the integrals. And I told him this idea for finding out how DNA replicates to see whether it would float up or down and that kind of thing in a sucrose gradient. And he was coming to Caltech the very next year in September, the very next September, to work with Joe Bertani. And so we agreed we'd do this together. But when Frank got there, he forbade us to start this because he said it would be bad for my character to not finish my thesis. And here, I don't know if I'm running over time. Would someone give me a hint? Well, I want to tell you an appalling story. So George Streisinger, a geneticist working in Max Delbruck's group, and I were trying to organize a conference on the biological effects of nuclear radiation, and because there was concern about fallout from big tests in the atmosphere. And we were unable to convene this conference, but it was taking up a lot of time. And one night I was in my lab in the basement of Gates' lab, and I heard this very characteristic sound of Linus Pauling approaching. He had some big leather, they may have been handmade, bedroom slippers. And at night he'd wear those things. You can go see them in Oregon at his archive. And so you could hear this slip-slop coming down the hall, and you knew it was Linus, and he was coming to see you late at night, and that meant it was something pretty important. He asked me to come up to his office, and he said he had two stories to tell me. And he, of course, was wearing his eyeglasses. And Linus had a habit of lowering them when he wanted to make a point, so looking at you directly. And he said, "Man, I want to tell you two stories. The first is about Socrates." Socrates, here he's playing with the Republic, Plato's Republic, was once asked, "What's the right activity for an old man?" And Socrates said, politics. And then Linus put his glasses back up on his nose. And then Socrates was asked, what is the right activity for a young man? And Socrates said, science. Now, my second story, Matt, is about Carl Friedrich Gauss. Do you know who? Yes, I do. Well, he was once asked, Gauss, why are you such a good mathematician? And Gauss thought a minute, according to Pauling, and said, whoa, I think it's because I never do anything else. And then Linus lowered his glasses one more time and said, it's been nice talking with you, Matt. And that was it. He never told you what to do, at least not me. I went back to NN prime dimethylmalonimide and finished it, I guess, sometime around 1955. And then Frank and I began. And we started with T4 because at Caltech at that time, it was okay to work with T4, but not with bacteria. That was French and Lederberg, and you don't do it. Even allowing lambda phage with Jean Weigel, Lederberg works on that too, so that was slightly. But T4 was okay. That was a Delbruck-approved phage system. So Frank and I started with T4. Now, with T4, we already knew there's a lot of genetic recombination because you can map it, lots of crossovers. And we knew that at least eukaryotic biologists thought that recombination is breakage and joining. And if that was going on, this is going to be hopeless. The DNA would all be messed up before the parent phage managed to make a lot of offspring phage and they come out of the cell. The DNA would be all broken up and re-put together in random ways, and it would look dispersive no matter what it really was. So we pinned our hopes on what's called copy choice, and I wanted to tell you a story about that. So Hershey and Rotman did a phage experiment in which they had two markers and two wild type on T phage, T2 or T4. And then they did single bursts and looked at each individual burst to see how many recombinants of this kind and how many recombinants of that kind. Now, in a meiosis, if you get this, you get this, except for a minor phenomenon called gene conversion. So what you do in the phage case is you plot a graph, which each single burst, you plot how many of this kind of recombinant came out, and in that same burst, how many of that kind, and they should fall in all exactly 45-degree line if the recombination was perfectly reciprocal, and the products reproduced perfectly equally, and matured perfectly equally, and were scored perfectly. Well, they weren't. The points were scattered around the 45-degree line, not infinitely far from it, but scattered. So Hershey reported this at a Cold Spring Harbor meeting, and Sturdivant was there, the famous student of Morgan, who I knew pretty well at Caltech, and got up and talked about copy choice as the explanation for the non-reciprocity. It was Sturdivant who resurrected copy choice. And I say resurrected because it was first proposed by a fellow named Belling at Cold Spring Harbor. And the idea was you have two chromosomes like this, they never get broken, and you synthesize a new chromosome by copying first along one, and then you switch and copy along the other, and then reciprocally you do the other thing. And so the two new chromosomes, this is in meiosis, of course we now know DNA synthesis happened long before pairing, but and so you get out the two old chromosomes intact, and the two new ones are completely new stuff, and that's copy choice. Belling himself later revised it. But anyway, that's what Sturdivant was saying. And this created a kind of epidemic of thinking about copy choice amongst phage biologists. It was taken seriously. Why did even the eukaryotic biologists believe in the breakage and joining? And that's the anecdote I want to tell you. This comes from two experiments. It seemed likely anyway, but it had first been proposed much earlier by a fellow named Janssens in Belgium. But two experiments, one by Barbara McClintock and Creighton, based on almost no data at all, and another by Kurt Stern, still in Germany. And the experiment's very simple. On the Drosophila X chromosome, he had a translocated big piece of something at one end of it and some other kind of visibly different thing at the other end, and two genetic markers. And in the female, you get recombination in Drosophila, and so you should get recombination of the shapes of what you see under the microscope in the chromosomes. So you first look for the recombination by looking at the phenotype of the recombinant in the males, and then you look at the chromosomes with a microscope and see if they look physically recombined. And they do, and so he concluded from this that materials are exchanged in the process of crossing over. And then he got a letter from Sturdivant. I know this because Stern came to Caltech in 1965 anniversary of Mendel's paper. And I went up to him and I asked him, well, couldn't copy choice give exactly the same result you got? You copy the features of the chromosome along with the genes, and you can't tell copy choice from breakage and joining. And I thought he was going to hit me, but I did want to know what he thought about it. Instead, he said, well, I got a letter from Sturtevant after I published that paper, and it said I'd proven nothing. So this shows Sturtevant was interested in copy choice way back. And I wrote back to Sturtevant, Stern said, and wrote and said, you're right, I proved nothing. Now, years later, I ran across Sturtevant at a biophysics meeting. By then, he had written his book, The History of Genetics. And in it, he said that Stern had proven that recombination, crossing over in eukaryotes, involves the exchange of materials. So I asked Stern, well, why is that? That you wrote him and said it was proving nothing, and now you say he proved it. Well, Sturt put his hand on my shoulder, I remember, and blew some of his pipe tobacco at me, and he said, and this goes to what Jack was telling us about. He said, oh, Matt, history is only what people think it is. Now, I don't agree with that altogether, but that's what. So I wanted to propagate that anecdote because it really is important in the history of genetics. It has nothing to do, I'm afraid, with Francis. So the next time I had anything to do with Francis was when Jim and Francis and I taught a course at Harvard, one-third. It was all of the students were just, many people have said that course changed their career. And Francis taught one-third of it, and that we dealt very closely together. And what impresses me in memory about Francis, quite aside from his brilliance, is his kindness. I always thought of Francis as an extremely kind man, at least to younger people. So now, so Frank and I finally could get this experiment going, but we were using T4, and for a heavy label, deuterium's no good. We used 5-bromouracil, and it was a complete mess, and for a whole year, nothing worked, except we did invent this method of equilibrium density gradient centrifugation with Jerry Vinograd, and we published that in 1957. But still, the phages were falling apart. We got to cesium gradients all right, but the phages fell apart in that. There was no way of getting uniform labeling of 5-bromouracil, so the bands were schmears, they weren't sharp. And then suddenly I decided, I don't know why, but it was okay to use bacteria in Max Delbruck's lab and switch to E. coli and to N15. And of course, you could have argued that E. coli has a lot of crossing over too, but it doesn't have that much. And anyway, that worked, and we published that in 1958. Frank and I were very slow in writing it up, and Max had to confine us to a jail room, at a tower room at the Caltech Marine Lab, and Manny Delbruck would bring us food until we wrote a manuscript. And we did write the first draft of the manuscript under those rendition, is that the word, conditions. So then there was the question of, well, how do we write the paper? And we decided that we were going to try to write the paper as though we knew nothing except what the experiment said, which meant that we knew nothing about the double helix. And therefore, all we could say was that the DNA is made up of 2 subunits, and when replication happens, they separate, and new subunits become associated with them, and that's that. Well, that meant that maybe these subunits are not individual polynucleotide chains. Of course, everybody thought they had to be, and it seemed the only reasonable explanation, and we thought that too. But logically, we like to write the paper in this way. And there was another reason for writing it in that way too, and that was that Paul Doty had published that when he heated salmon sperm DNA, it collapsed, but the molecular weight didn't go down as measured by light scattering. Now, light scattering is very tricky for large molecules, and in fact, wrong in this case. The molecular weight, I'm sure, dropped by half, but he thought it didn't. But our DNA, our hybrid DNA, when we heated it, the heavy and light came apart beautifully and formed separate bands. So how can it be that salmon sperm DNA, when you heat it, collapses all right, like a double helix should, like had first been shown by René Thomas in Brussels, and by John Gulland, who is, maybe Jack would say that John, not John, Masson Gulland had contributed a further thing that was background to the double helix, the collapse and the hydrogen bonds and all that. So maybe it meant that the DNA we had studied was more complicated than salmon sperm DNA. Maybe it had 4 chains, who knows? So this led to some further work. A graduate student in my lab showed by sonication that the hybrid DNA still stayed hybrid, so the subunits weren't joined end to end. And then later, another graduate student in my lab, John Menninger, by low-angle X-ray scattering, showed that the linear density of the DNA from E. coli was that for a double helix, not for two of them or four of them or six of them. And that was proven much better by John Cairns later when he measured the linear density of lambda DNA, and so on and so forth. Now, I want to say a few more not very well organized things. It was extraordinary fun to be working at that time. Graduate students, there was absolutely no pressure of any kind, great excitement. Some of it is conveyed not from what was happening at Caltech, but in Francis's book, What Mad Pursuit, and of course in Jim's book, The Double Helix. So I want to end on, Francis, of course, and together often with Sydney, but was kind of the intellectual leader of the whole coding problem and all the thing, adapters, all that. But there was another leader, a dictator, in fact, and that was the DNA molecule itself. Because if you look at a lipid molecule or a carbohydrate molecule or a molecule even of a protein, it doesn't really tell you what to do. But the DNA molecule stood there and said, here I am, I have these two chains, you go figure out how I replicate. And then it said, here I am, I have this sequence of bases, and it can be in any order. That's information, you go figure out what it's saying. And then it said, at least in eukaryotes, I'm in the nucleus, and the proteins are made in the cytoplasm. And later we learned on the ribosome. So something must carry my information out to there. You go figure out what it is. And then it said, I do something called crossing over. That's breakage and joining. By the way, double density gradient centrifugation was used for that. And also with another grad student in my lab, Rick Davern, to show in 1960 that the RNA of ribosomes is molecularly conserved. I have to tell you a short story about Linus in that regard, too. So we could only do that with more heavy isotope labeling than you could get with nitrogen-15 alone. So the next obvious one would be carbon-13. Use them both together. Hydrogen's no good. It's always going on and off. Well, I contacted the AEC. They didn't have any. Chalk River in Canada, no. The Japanese, no. When the people here in Britain, the Atomic Energy Authority, they didn't have any either, except 1 or 2% enrichment. So Linus was just then elected to the Academia Nau, the Soviet Academy. So he sent a telex, there was no email, to Nezmeyanov, the organic chemist, who was the president of the Academia Nau, saying, could you make for me 1 gram of carbon-13? And we got back a telex, said, yes, you'll have it in 1 year. We found that puzzling, but we thought maybe it's the bureaucracy there. They have to get a lot of approvals. 1 year later, we got another telex. Your carbon-13, 99% isotopically pure, is ready. Do you want it in methane or graphite? So I decided on methane because I knew how to convert that to to broth for bacteria to eat. And three huge green boxes arrived at Caltech, along with a man from, I think, the FBI. And inside was sawdust and a big glass sphere with a glass attachment, sidearm. And that was the methane. And without that, we couldn't have done any of the experiments that showed, for example, that recombination in lambda involves breakage, that the RNA of ribosomes is stable. And then when Francois Jacob and Sidney Brenner came to the lab, because I had the only lab that could do this experiment, I was the junior partner, I ran the centrifuge. And Sidney counted the plaques on one of my experiments at night. I don't think he slept at all. Francois sat in a chair. It was humid, and he had shrapnel in his legs from his service with the Free French. And the humidity made him, since it's 100% humidity inside our bodies, I've never understood why it is, but it seems true that people get some kinds of bone pain for certain people when it's humid and not otherwise. I have a hypothesis, but I don't know if it's right. It's very mysterious. Anyway, why am I telling you this? So the Soviet Union has to be given some credit for the discovery of messenger RNA, oddly enough. What else? That's about it. So thank you very much.